This is Audible.
Sounds True presents The Power of Vulnerability, teachings on authenticity, courage, and connection with Brené Brown. And now Session 1, Why We Struggle.
So thank y'all for being here. I'm actually going to start by telling the story of my worst speaking experience ever. And I've told this story a couple times, so if you follow my work, you may have heard it. But it's a very, I think, an important place to start. So this was about 5 or 6 years ago, and I got an invitation to speak at a luncheon at a country club. And it was a huge deal for me because it was the first time I'd ever been asked to speak to the public, what I call normal people, as opposed to other academics and researchers, who I do not refer to as normal people. And so I was really excited. So I get to the country club. I get all dressed up in my, this is like this, dressed up and fancy clogs. And I get there and there's a woman standing behind the podium kind of sorting things out. She has on a very expensive St. John's suit. She has her hair pulled back in a bun that was so tight that I was surprised that she could breathe. And she was very fastidious looking. I knew immediately that she was the person running the show. So I walked up and I said, "Hi, I'm Brené Brown from the University of Houston." And she didn't even extend her hand. She just kind of stepped back and went like this. And she said, "You don't look like a researcher." And of course, my thought is like, I should have worn a white coat, or something. And so I said, "No, I am. I'm from the University of Houston." And she said, "Do you have your bio? I'll need to introduce you when the crowd gets here." And I said, "Sure." So I handed her my bio. She sets it on the podium. She puts her reading glasses on. This is exactly what she did. Oh my God. Oh my God. And I thought, did I just like print out an email or something? Like what did I, which, we're going to spend a lot of time together. You'll know that that is way in the realm of possibility. So I was like, what did I hand her? And she's turned to me and she said, "This bio says that you study shame." Just the way she was speaking to me. And we'll talk about this a lot over the sessions. Immediately, I was small. And immediately, I was 10. You know, and so when she said that, my response was, "Yes, ma'am, I study shame." And she said, "I was told that you study how to be beautiful and successful." My first thought is, holy shit. And I said, "No, ma'am, I don't. I study the things that get in the way of feeling like we're enough." And she said, "What else do you study? Do you study anything else besides shame?" And this is where I knew it was going to get really ugly, because I said, "Yes, ma'am, fear and vulnerability." So she grabs the bio off the podium and she said, "I'll be back in just a minute. This is just not acceptable." So she walks out of the room and walks outside and is pacing. I know, because the whole back of this ballroom is glass and I can see her pacing. So she comes back and she says, she puts a bio on the podium and she said, "Let me tell you exactly how this is going to go today." And of course I say, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "There will be no mention of the word shame." She said, "First of all, people will be eating," which is like the first time I ever thought my work makes people barf, you know, we can't do it while we're eating. And she said, "Secondly, no one's interested in tough topics. People love how to. How to be beautiful, how to be successful, how to be popular." So I said, "Well, I can't really do that." She, "Yes, you will do that. You will talk about how to be happy. That's what I thought you were going to do, and that's what I've told everybody." So, yes, it's that funny. It's so for an hour, I stood behind a podium with like 300 people eating, going like this. Happy is incredibly important. To be happy is equally important. To feel, that's all I could say for an hour. Well, a lot of polite people went. And what was funny about this experience to me is something that was life-changing, actually. It was horrific, and I cried the whole way home. I cried because I think I looked like a crazy person, but I also cried because why didn't I just say, hey, this is what I do, and I'd be happy to talk, but this is what I'm going to be talking about, which I think is the difference between right before midlife and mid-40s. Yeah, because I'm 46 now, and there's no way in hell that would go over. I would have been like, made a beeline the second I got the, you know. But what was great is when she was leaving, after she told me that I was going to talk about this, and she told me that people don't like to talk about hard stuff, she was walking out, and she turned back, and she said, the deal is light and breezy. People like light, in case I didn't get the verb, the verbiage. She gave me hand signals. People like light and breezy. I write about this story in The Gifts of Imperfection. I said it was kind of like Margaret Thatcher meets Bob Fosse. It was just very jazz handsy. But the reason why this was so helpful for me is because it helped me understand the difficulty in talking about my work. And we do live in a culture of how-to. You know, one of the things that's been a very incredible struggle for me personally is that if I have a new book come out or if I have something going on in my work, the invitations that I often get are, hey, will you write something for this magazine? Like, 5 tips to be less embarrassed when you're naked. Or, you know, and I'm like, that's not the nature of my work. That's not what I do. And so what we're going to do over these 6 sessions is we're going to not talk about how-to. Because how-to doesn't work. If how-to worked, none of us would be struggling. Because we're all smart enough to get how-to. We'll talk about this later, but I'll hit it now because it's worth repeating. If how-to worked, we would not be the most obese, in debt, medicated, and addicted adults in human history. If how-to worked, we wouldn't be struggling as much as we are with feeling lonely and disconnected. And mostly if how-to worked, if how to be happy worked, all of us, myself included, every single person in this room, would not struggle all the time with feeling like we're enough. Because we would just follow the tips and tricks. And so what we're going to do over the sessions is we're going to walk into some of the hard conversations, because I think that's where the transformation happens. And so we're going to start talking about culture, and we're going to start where we are, what we're living in right now. And I'm often asked, how would you describe the culture we're in today? What are we up against? To me, we can't address issues if we don't know the soup that we're swimming in. And so I think it's really important right off the bat to unpack culture and what we're living in. And when I'm asked, what is the culture that defines our experience today, I would say that we live in a culture of deep scarcity, defined by this: never enough. You can fill in the blanks. Never good enough, rich enough, powerful enough, safe enough, certain enough, perfect enough, extraordinary enough. And one of the most least discussed, but probably most dangerous not enoughs that we're up against is not relevant enough. It is the biggest trigger of shame in the workplace. How many of you are working in a situation right now where the motto is do more with less? And how many of you are working in a situation that is changing every single day? And the question is, are my contributions meaningful? The idea of never extraordinary enough, and we're really going to unpack this in a little bit too. We live in a culture today where somehow this idea that if we're not doing extraordinary, huge public things, that we are not enough. That somehow leading an ordinary life, waking up in the morning, loving the people around us, doing our best work, being a part of a community, an ordinary life, is synonymous with a meaningless life. And one of the most, to me, astounding examples of this was Rutgers University. last year paid the highest honorarium it's ever paid in the history of the college to Snooki. I like that so much. That was like a, oh God, are you kidding? Yeah. And what makes that so amazing to me in so many different ways, there was a cartoon, I don't remember where it ran, in the New Yorker or one of the big magazines that said, every time someone watches the Jersey Shore, a book commits suicide. But what was so remarkable about this honorarium, the highest ever going to a reality TV star, I don't care who it is that she was paid that money the same month Maya Angelou came into Rutgers to give the commencement address and was paid less. You know, there's this idea that it doesn't matter why people know everything you're doing as long as they know. You know how we look back at mental health institutions from 100 years ago and wince, and we think, how could we have done that? My real belief is that we'll look back 100 years from now at reality television and think, can you believe we let kids be on those shows? You know, can you believe that we, it's just shocking to me. But it plays into this idea that we're never extraordinary enough. Another example of this, Facebook, Twitter, all of the social media. One of the things that's been very interesting to me is whenever I go around and travel, people often ask me questions about, is that narcissism? You know, and you, how many of you heard that word tossed around a lot lately? There's a book released every week on narcissism. And as a mental health professional, it makes me wince a little bit because, you know, narcissistic personality disorder is a pretty defined disorder and pretty serious disorder. But I think if you look at those behaviors through a vulnerability lens, what you'll see is this. The shame-based fear of being ordinary. That if 2,000 people don't know that I just had a bikini wax, my life is no longer worth living. You know, and so I think when kids especially are raised on a steady diet of celebrity culture and this idea, we can see why a lot of us are not making the right choices for us around intimacy and privacy and social media. But I think it goes back to scarcity. I think it goes back to the idea of living in a culture where we believe that there's just not enough, that we are hyper aware of lack. There is a great book by my friend Lynn Twist called The Soul of Money. And she writes about scarcity. And I'll paraphrase here. She says, the first thing we do in the morning before our feet even hit the floor is we think to ourselves, I didn't get enough sleep. And the very last thought we have as our head hits the pillow every night is, I didn't get enough done. And everything in between those two moments is a litany of scarcity. And so how did we end up here? How did we end up in this culture of scarcity? I want to describe a case scenario for you. And I want to talk about it a little bit. Two families, two brothers. Each of them have a couple of kids and a partner. Unexpectedly, there is a very violent traumatic event. And one of the children in this family dies. And the whole family, as you can imagine, both brothers, the partners, the kids, very devastated. It's a significant violent trauma. Over the course of the next couple of years, they send, each one of them sends one of their children to war. One child comes back, one does not. A year after that, one brother loses his house. It's foreclosed. So what would you expect, looking at this system, family system as a unit, what would you expect their emotional lives to be like? Traumatic. What else? Fearful. Devastated. How are they behaving toward each other? And they can't connect. What else? They could use it as an opportunity. shut down. So I would argue, somewhat controversially often, that family is us. And that first violent trauma was 9/11. And that after that, we've been in multiple wars. We've been through an economic downturn, recession, that I don't think anyone in this room statistically would be so far removed from that it didn't affect them somehow. And that's us. That's the community. That's our family. If you look back over the last 11 or 12 years, it has been trauma after trauma for us. And I'm aware of it because I started my research in the year 9/11 happened. And so I've watched scarcity absolutely shift over this period of time. It is not the same now as when I started. It's just different. People are more fearful. But someone in the audience said it could be amazing. And we're going to talk about how it could be amazing today. I think it could be amazing. I think that it can only be amazing, though, for that family system in the story or for us, if we acknowledge what we've been through. And if we turn to each other for support and compassion and not against each other. I mean, I think everything that you see today from the political culture that we're in is really about fear. And I think the good news is, and I really sense this, I mean, and my job is to stay connected to people and understand what's happening in culture. I really think for the first time in a decade that I've been doing this research, 12 years actually, I think we're tired of being afraid. I think we're tired of the conversation being, what should we fear and who should we blame? And I think we're ready for a new conversation, but I can guarantee you this, we will not get there without conversations about vulnerability and shame. We just can't get to the other side of that conversation. So there are three, what I find in scarcity-bound cultures, there are three elements that exist. The first is that they're shame-prone cultures. Scarcity seems to thrive in shame-prone cultures. And whether we like it or not in the U.S., we are so good at saying, boy, look at these countries over there. They use a lot of shame. We are an absolute shame-prone culture. I don't mean that we're ashamed of who we are. I mean, we use shame. You know, you want to look at bullying. You want to look at politics. You want to look at a religion. You want to look at just cultural conversations. We use shame. We use personal attacks. We use teardowns. That's how we are heard in our culture. The second element is a culture that's deeply seated in comparison is very vulnerable to becoming a scarcity culture. I have a friend, Laura Williams, who says comparison is the thief of happiness. How many of you have ever had one of those days where you're like, God, things are going pretty well? And then in a split second, you hold your life up or yourself up against someone else. And everything that was going pretty well 30 milliseconds before you thought of that is just crap. You know, comparison is really dangerous. And the last one is a culture fractured by disengagement. I just finished a new book. It's coming out in September of this year, and it's called Daring Greatly. And Daring Greatly is part of a quote from the Theodore Roosevelt speech, The Man in the Arena, that says, it's not the critic who counts. It's not the man who points at, you know, at the man in the arena who is stumbling and falling. The people who count are the people in the arena. And we're often, if you're in the arena and you're letting yourself be seen and you're showing up, you're going to get your ass kicked. Let me just give you that right now. In this culture, the only way to avoid that is to contribute and say and do nothing. But if you're in the arena, and I don't care if that's a difficult family conversation, sharing a creative idea, putting your new pottery on Etsy, I don't care what your arena is, speaking up at a PTO meeting, telling someone that you're dating that you love him, whatever your arena is, we're going to get kicked around. But it's not the critic who counts. It's not the person who points and says, you should have never done that, or look at you, everyone's laughing. It's those of us who are willing to show up and let ourselves be seen. And what I see right now, especially in 2010, I did the TED Talk in Houston. In 2011, it went completely viral. Someone says yes, totally unexpectedly. And so I spent the year traveling and speaking a lot more than I will ever do again, actually. To be honest with you, and I said yes a lot more than I should have because I was in scarcity. Because I thought, because I, you know, total imposter, like, holy crap, they're calling me. Yes, I'll be there. Because if I say no, then they'll stop asking, right? Or they'll find out that I really am not totally sure what I'm talking about. It's true. So I spent a lot of time in 2011 on the road, which is not good for me. But the one thing I saw, whether I was in a Fortune 100 corporation, I was in a school, I was talking to a congregation and a faith community, the number one problem I think we face in this country today that is absolutely underpinning scarcity is disengagement. We are just disengaged. And I see it everywhere. We're going to learn over our time together that the way to change a scarcity culture is to be very subversive and create another culture in our lives, at work, in our homes. Because when I talk about scarcity culture, I mean cultures and families. There are families that are deeply, deeply enmeshed in comparison, that are deeply disengaged, that use shame a lot. When I talk about culture, I don't just mean the big zeitgeist that we all live in. I mean family culture, work culture, neighborhood culture. We have to change those little cultures. Mary Pfeiffer, who wrote Reviving Ophelia, says social change is a million individual acts of kindness. Cultural change is a million subversive acts of resistance. It's deciding not to live in scarcity in our families. It's deciding to let go of comparison in our jobs. And we'll talk about that. So now that we understand what scarcity is, let me walk you a little bit back into the research. So for me, I did spend the first 6 years studying shame, fear, vulnerability, and empathy. At the end of those 6 years, I put a theory into the literature. I wrote a book on shame resilience. At the end of those 6 years, I had a very different question that I wanted to answer because along the way, I had interviewed, I'm a qualitative researcher, so I do long interviews, individuals, focus groups, sometimes larger groups with doctoral students who'll come and help. I had interviewed people who just like us wake up every day in the same culture of scarcity that we wake up in, but they live differently than us. These were people who, when I was in the process of interviewing them, they would say things to me like this. Yeah, I mean, I read the magazines and I know what I'm supposed to look like and I know what my house is supposed to look like. But you know, to be honest with you, I work really hard just to wake up every morning and say, I'm enough. I was like, well, how in the hell does that happen? Like, you know, what do you do? What's the secret? But I interviewed a significant number, certainly not the majority of the people I'd interviewed, I would describe that way, but enough that I thought, qualitative research is, I love it, and you probably do it all the time without knowing that you're doing it. It's basically, I'm a story catcher, and I collect stories. I always say that, you know, stories are data with a soul. I collect stories, and I look for patterns and themes that emerge over and over in those stories. And one of the ways we evaluate our research is we look for saturation, and that means I interview 30 of you, and a theme or pattern keeps coming up and coming up. And it comes up with such regularity that I can predict it's going to keep happening. And it does keep happening. And so that's saturation. It was certainly, there were not enough of these folks to saturate, but there was enough to get started. So what I did is I grabbed a file folder and I wrote the name that came to mind for me. And that was Wholehearted. I wanted to go back in the data and find the men and women who were living and loving with their whole hearts because they were there and I wanted to know what they were doing that was different than the rest of us. I wanted to know what they shared in common. And if you know my story, you will know that this does not turn out well for a little while. Because I'll be honest with you, I thought the answer was going to be what the wholehearted share in common is a vast, expansive knowledge base around shame. The wholehearted are shame researchers. And I honestly thought that. I went into this research looking for confirmation that I was indeed wholehearted, just not aware of it yet. Yeah. The first thing that I will tell you that I learned was that love and belonging are irreducible needs of men, women, and children. I mean, I will go on the record as saying, in the absence of love and belonging, there is always suffering. Period. This was a rocky start for me because up until this point, including the first book and the theory that I wrote on shame, I had never used the word love. Because it would be a very difficult sell to tell my colleagues to use the word love in research. Because how do you measure love? And how do you talk about love? And so what we do in the, you know, in, as researchers is we just dismiss its importance because we can't define it or measure it, which really makes no sense at all. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I was talking to 3,000 academics in my field in social work in San Antonio at a conference. And I said, how many of you talk about love? And these were all basically the academics that represent the entire faculty of social work nationally. How many of you talk about love? Two hands went up out of 3,000. And I said, let me ask you this. How many of you, the doors are closed behind us, how many of you today would be willing to walk outside of this room and never experience love again? No one raised their hand. I said, how many of you believe that love is the absolutely most important human experience? Everyone raised their hand. And I said, then why aren't we talking about it? You know, because we can't measure it. That's a terrible reason to not talk about something that we all know is universally important. So what I did in my work is I came up with a definition of love, which is at best ballsy, at worst stupid. For this reason, we have to have a conversation about love. And I don't think we talk about it because there's no definition of it. We don't know what we're talking about. So I'm upset. A big part of grounded theory research is to cultivate definitions from the research. And so I'm going to share a lot of definitions over the six sessions. But what I want to tell you is that I'm just trying to provoke you. I'm not trying to sell you the definition. I'm just starting a conversation. Bell Hooks, who's one of my favorite writers, she's a feminist and a critic and English professor, she says that language is a place of struggle. And I don't think if we don't at least start to try to define something that we can't even discuss it because we don't even have a shared vocabulary to disagree. So here's how I would define love. And so what I did is I went into all of my research and put together what I thought love was based on the data. Love. We cultivate love when we allow our most vulnerable and powerful selves to be deeply seen and known. And when we honor the spiritual connection that grows from that offering with trust, respect, kindness, and affection. I saw no examples of love in the last 12 years that did not include trust, respect, kindness, and affection. Love is not something we give or get. It's something that we nurture and grow, a connection that can only be cultivated between two people when it exists within each one of them. We can only love others as much as we love ourselves. This was the absolute bad news. And for sure, the most controversial part of my research. And then this would be the second most controversial on this definition. Shame, blame, disrespect, betrayal, and the withholding of affection damage the roots from which love grows. Love can only survive these injuries if they are acknowledged, healed, and rare. So what struck me about this definition, I was actually kind of devastated by this whole process. The whole idea that we can't love other people more than we love ourselves. And the pushback I get on this all the time are from parents who say, that's not true. I love my child much more than I love myself. And I have to tell you again, in a dozen years, I have seen no evidence of that really happening. Because especially as our children get older. I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old son. And what I see now as she's in her teenage years is those things that I dislike about me the most are surfacing in her. And so when she comes home and says, no one sat with me today at lunch, I have to have a whole lot of self-love for that 13-year-old inside of me that also had nowhere to sit at lunch many, many times in order to respond to her without shame or blame. Does that make sense? Because what I see a lot in the research is I see children coming home and saying, no one sat with me at lunch. And mom turning to her and saying, I told you, wear a nicer outfit and pull your damn hair back. Right. And we do that. And so I don't think that we can love other people more than we love ourselves, which is why when I think it comes to our partners and our children and our family, our first order of business is the development of self-love. So let's talk about belonging. I knew belonging was a big deal going into this research, but I had no idea what a big deal it was. Here's the definition that came up. Belonging is the innate human desire to be a part of something larger than us. Because this yearning is so primal, we often try to acquire it by fitting in and seeking approval, which are not only hollow substitutes for belonging, but often barriers to it. True belonging only happens when we present our authentic and perfect selves to the world. Our sense of belonging can never be greater than our level of self-acceptance. So here's what was shocking to me. Guess what emerged as the primary barrier to cultivating belonging in people? Shame, self-worth, vulnerability, judgment, fear, comparison. Okay. All of these come together to create the number one barrier to belonging: fitting in. Fitting in emerges the primary barrier to cultivating real belonging. Because fitting in is about assessing a situation and acclimating. And why do we assess and acclimate? We assess and acclimate out of fear and shame and all the judgment, all the things that you just named. Right? So here's what's interesting. Y'all are a group of folks who I really like. You're doing interesting stuff and you're, you know, part of my community back in Houston. And I really want to connect with y'all. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of observe. I'm going to ask some questions and I'm going to fit. And let me tell you, I'm an expert fitter-inner. I mean, I study vulnerability for a living. I have to know you for 20 minutes to know exactly how to fit in with you. And I also need to know you for about 20 minutes to know exactly what to say to bring you to your knees. Because it's what I study for a living. And while it's kind of a superpower for me that I only choose to use for good, most of us have this ability. Especially if there are mental health professionals in the audience. You know, we know exactly. So I'm going to fit in. I know exactly, you know, okay, so they're kind of the high-end athletic wear. Steer away from these conversations. Steer toward these conversations. I got it. So I come to you, to your meeting, and I really want connection, and I'm craving some belonging, and I do everything I can do to fit in, and it doesn't work out. I don't feel connection. I don't feel accepted. The result of that experiment, 9 times out of 10, will be shame. Because my goal in this effort was to be accepted and to fit in. And I failed. Okay. You guys are another group of people that I really want to fit in with. I want to be a part of your thing. I want to be in your tribe. So what I do is I say, instead of saying like, okay, who are you? What do you wear? How do you dress? How do you vote? What's important? I just say, I have my own authenticity mantra. I'm going to invite you to do it as well later. So my authenticity mantra is, I have a couple. One of them is, don't shrink, don't puff up. Just stand your sacred ground. My vulnerability mantra is show up and let yourself be seen. So instead of trying to fit in, I just go, I'm driving. I mean, I do this all the time. Okay. Just show up, let yourself be seen, be real. Don't shrink. And by shrink, I mean, don't whatever you like, I like, whatever you listen to, like basically my dating life for about 10 years. Yeah, whatever you do, that's what I do. And even better. But just be myself. So you're a new book club. I hated the book. And I'm not going to be like, I hate the book and y'all suck for liking it. But I'm just going to say, you know, if it's my turn, it didn't resonate with me. I didn't get it. I'm just going to let myself be seen. And I go and there's no connection. I don't feel a sense of belonging at all. Rarely, rarely do we see the outcome of that experiment or of that effort. Rarely is it shame. It's disappointment, grief, maybe a little confusion. But it's rarely shame because my self-worth was not on the line. My goal was not, above all else, to get you to like me. My goal was to show up and let myself be seen. And I did that. And so there is no failure there for me. Does that make sense? So what I think is interesting is that fitting in emerges as the primary barrier to belonging. And how many of us are super good at fitting in? I think most of us. So first thing I learned from talking to the wholehearted, love and belonging, irreducible needs of men, women, and children. And I can clearly see as a researcher that this is going to be very difficult work because self-acceptance and self-love are at the heart of both of these. What else do they share in common? If you took all of the people I've interviewed over the last 12 years and you divided them crudely into two groups, people who have a deep sense of love and belonging and people who struggle for it, there was only one variable that separated these groups. And let me go back and say this. To have a deep sense of love does not just mean the capacity to love other people. It means a deep sense of being lovable, which is where most people go, oh, it was so much better when it was loving other people. But when I say a deep sense of love and belonging, I mean not only do you have the capacity to love, but you believe that you're deeply lovable. So if you took these groups, this group struggles, this group feels a deep sense. The only difference was that men and women who have a deep sense of love and belonging believe they are worthy of love and belonging. That's it. Okay, that pissed me off beyond anything I probably have ever found in my work. Because my question was, what does that mean? They have a deep sense of love and belonging, and they believe they're worthy of it. That they wake up one day and they say, you know what? I am worthy of love and belonging. You know, like that thing. And if that's the case, what are the prerequisites? What do I need to do that? And so I actually called back a lot of the doctoral students who work with me and said, we need to go through the literature because something is amiss. What does believing that you're worthy of love and belonging look like? And maybe the people who believe they're worthy of love and belonging are that mystical group of people that we all want to belong to, but we can't get in. Like the people who their nail polish doesn't chip. They don't get stretch marks. They're, you know, everything goes great. They're beautiful. They're famous. They're rich. I don't know who they are. But you know what? There was this gnawing sense in me. I knew at some terrible gut level that that was not going to be the finding because I've interviewed everyone from homeless men and women, people transitioning out of federal prison to the junior league. And let me just tell you this. Every single person has a story that'll break your heart. And if you're paying attention, many people from both of those sides have a story that'll bring you to your knees. Nobody rides for free. Even though I wanted to find that the wholehearted were people whose lives had turned out more beautifully than the rest of ours, I had a feeling that that was not going to be the case, and it was not. They did not have fewer divorces, fewer incidents of addiction, fewer traumas, nothing. The only difference was in the midst of their struggle, their worthiness was not on the table. And I got to tell you that, and I've never talked about this before, but I think it's important to say, and it's hard for me to put percentages on things sometimes because I'm a qualitative researcher, but I would say that of the wholehearted probably are about 20% of the people I've interviewed over time. Out of the wholehearted, I would say maybe 25, 30% of them were parented that way. And the other 75% fought their way to wholeheartedness. I mean, every now and then I will run into someone who said, you know, my parents just raised me that way. If I failed, they said, you failed. You're not a failure. In fact, you're brave for trying. But the majority of people who I've interviewed over the years who would really kind of meet this conditions, I call them inclusion criteria for wholeheartedness, fought their way there. And that was very helpful for me because there wasn't a magical group. There were a group of people who made different choices every single day than what the rest of us make, mostly. And so what I came up with were guideposts. There were about 10 things that the wholehearted did differently than the rest of us. And we're going to fully unpack those 10 things in the last couple of sessions. We're going to go through each of the guideposts. And the great thing about being a shame researcher, I'm so grateful that I started there first and then found my way to wholeheartedness and joy and gratitude, because every time I hear what someone's doing, I ask them what gets in the way. So I'll give you an example. One of the 10 guideposts, and again, we're going to unpack these in later sessions, but one of the 10 guideposts is that the wholehearted absolutely cultivate rest and play. They rest more than the rest of us rest, and they play more than the rest of us play. But that was not good enough for me as a researcher because, first of all, I didn't even know what play was when it merged. I just took field notes and called another researcher, Rhonda Deering, and said, the wholehearted fool around a lot. And she said, what do you mean? She said, sex? And I said, well, that too, but they are total time slacker waster people. And she said, I don't know. I'm like, they piddle. I don't know what they're doing. I don't even know what it's called. But it makes me come out of my skin just to hear them describe it. And she couldn't even help me with it. She's like, I don't know. It sounds terrible. And I said, it is. It's weird, and I don't know what it is. And then it wasn't until several months later when I was in the backyard sitting on a lawn chair watching my kids jump on our trampoline where I was like, oh, my God, that's play. And then it was such a foreign idea to me that I thought I had invented the importance of it. I even texted Steve and I said, adult play is important. This is going to send my career to the moon. I was like, who knew? And of course, there's like 10,000 play researchers who have dedicated their entire careers. Like, I'm late to the play game. Clearly not a player. Maybe a playa, but not a player. Honestly, neither. But so I was interested in, okay, so you play. Neato for you. What gets in the way of play and rest? Like, I want to know, what are the shame tapes that you have to overcome to play? Not enough. Not doing enough. Get your work done. Lazy. Perfectionism. There's more where that came from. What will people think? Need the money. I haven't earned it. Oh, my God. Okay. So, y'all get the A+ in shame. I don't know what that means, but y'all are on it. So the big gremlins, the big shame triggers that emerged were exhaustion as a status symbol and productivity as self-worth. So as we go through these guideposts in the later sessions, we'll not only go through what the wholehearted are doing, but we'll go through what the shame triggers are that the rest of us need to overcome because they've had to overcome it. So what we've got so far in the question of wholeheartedness is this. Love and belonging, irreducible needs of men, women, and children. People who live from a place of deep sense of love and belonging make different choices than when we make, and I call those the guideposts for wholeheartedness, which we're going to talk about. And then the next one. Wholehearted folks embrace vulnerability. So most of you know this story, but I'll tell it anyway for those who don't. I became a researcher specifically to avoid vulnerability. Again, fifth generation Texan. Family motto, lock and load. No interest at all in vulnerability. Was not raised, did not ever see that modeled by my parents. Never even, there was never a conversation. Like, they didn't sit us down when we were two and say vulnerability is weakness. But that's the way we lived. The vulnerability is weakness. And that you don't do vulnerability. And I tried a lot of different things on to avoid vulnerability, you know, and very predictable things like, I was a clove-smoking poet for a while. I was like an angry activist. I was a corporate climber. I was wild party girl. Somewhat predictable developmental stages, but really for me fueled by two big things. Don't let anyone too close and always have an exit strategy. You know, just kind of the way I lived. When I was getting my master's degree in social work, I'd already gotten a bachelor's degree in social work, so I was clearly slow to the game. It started to dawn on me that this profession was not what I thought it was, and that social work was not about fixing people. It was about being with people where they are and holding an empathic space for people to do their own work. Oh, God. Very difficult for someone like me who prided themselves on being right and knowing exactly what everyone else needed to be doing at all times. So I really, toward the end of my social work, my master's degree, figured this is not for me. Until I got into a research class where we were told on the first day, quote, by an adjunct faculty person, interestingly enough, who was not a social worker, I don't know what kind of crap you're learning in these other classes, but in here, it's about prediction and control. If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. And I fell in love, because I am about prediction and control. That's why I became a researcher. So you can only imagine, and I'll tell you the full story of this. I can't even do the math, 5 years ago when all this happened, and I was getting ready to code the wholehearted data. And Steve took my kids out of town because whenever I start coding data, in grounded theory, you don't use software. You manually code everything. And so Steve and I had already been going back and forth because before my oldest, Ellen, could read, I would have walls, entire walls in our house covered with those big post-it, you know, those poster-sized post-its. And then on those poster-sized post-its, hundreds of smaller post-its. And that's how I would code and move data. And there would be like death and grief, trauma, you know, and Steve would say, she can read. Yeah, pull this crap. This is not how normal people live. Cause when you go into data collection, Barney Glaser, who's one of the methodologists who invented grounded theory, calls it the drugless trip. Cause you're kind of always thinking about things. Like even today, like I was eating breakfast this morning and I wrote something on my notepad and then wrote, you know, you're just kind of thinking about relationships. And so he took the kids out of town for the weekend and I started coding data. And the more I coded the data, the more I realized that things were not going to be what I thought. Shame researchers were not by default wholehearted people. But clearly this issue was the big one, that how much we know ourselves is extremely important. But how we treat ourselves is the most important. And I don't know about you, but knowing is much easier to me than feeling. And I'm sure that's not true for all of you. But for me, knowing is much easier. So as I started writing, basically I had two big poster-sized post-it notes up. And I would go through the data and it was basically crudely a wholehearted people do this and don't do this. And so they fool around because I didn't know play. They sleep. We'll talk about this one again in a later session. They're creative, which is super bad news for someone like me. Like, they're all creative. Not one single wholehearted person that I interviewed failed to engage in some kind of creativity. They all did something creative. And then what did they not do? Because I was looking for the shame things. What were the shame triggers that held them away? So you can only imagine for someone who became a researcher to avoid vulnerability, what happened when the word vulnerability came up about 600 times in the first set of data. I let myself be vulnerable. I engage with vulnerability. I feel vulnerable. I'm not afraid to be vulnerable. I'm not scared of vulnerability. I let people see how I'm feeling. So wholehearted men and women engage with their vulnerability. This was devastating for me because I became a researcher clearly to avoid vulnerability. So at the end of this process, I actually put my data away for a year and got a therapist. And really, and took all my poster side stuff and put it on a syllabus in Excel that had all of the issues that I needed to work on based on the data in the order of importance and exactly how much time I would allot for each issue. I'm not kidding. And I will say Diana was my therapist and she retired. I was her last client. Which is true story. So I went in the first day and I said, I have a vulnerability issue. I have 6 weeks to work on it. And I said, I told her. And I said, no childhood bullshit. I'm not doing all that family of origin, hokey pokey. I would like some very specific strategies and tips and something I could implement right off the bat. I tell this, I talk about this in the TED. She looked at me and she literally went, I said, is that bad? And that's when she said, it's neither good nor bad, Brene. It just is what it is. Shit. I don't like things that are not binary. Like 1-0, good, bad. So it took me a year. And you know, even I think in the gifts of imperfection, even when I write about this, I say that I got hijacked by my data. But the truth is I got rescued by it. You know, it changed my life. And it took me places I didn't want to go, dragging and screaming. But it was an incredible, experience. Especially for someone who was so afraid to be vulnerable and so afraid to let myself be seen and so afraid to be anybody but what other people needed. I'm the oldest of four. Yeah, I'm a firstborn. My sisters call me Sister Superior, you know. Performing, pleasing, proving, perfecting is the way I did things. And so one of the things I learned about vulnerability from the research that I took into this process for me was why we're afraid of vulnerability. We think about vulnerability as a dark emotion. You know, there are a lot of people who talk about light, positive emotions, negative emotions, dark emotions, light emotions. We think of vulnerability as a dark emotion. We think of it as the core of fear and shame and grief and disappointment, uncertainty, things that we do not want to feel, right? Things that I don't want to be vulnerable because that means I'm afraid. That means I'm uncertain. That means I'm at risk. I'm exposed. I'm in grief. So what we do is we armor up. And we say, I do not want to slip into these dark emotions. I will not let myself be vulnerable. But here's what I learned from the research and certainly put into motion in my own life that was the most life-changing, is that vulnerability is the center of difficult emotion. But it's also the birthplace of every positive emotion that we need in our lives. Love. Belonging, joy, empathy. How many of you would agree that we're in a serious empathy deficit in our culture today? Totally, right? No vulnerability, no empathy. In a culture where people are afraid to be vulnerable, you can't have empathy. You know, empathy is not a default response. If you share something with me that's difficult, in order for me to be truly empathic, I have to step into what you're feeling. And that's vulnerable. So there can be no empathy without vulnerability. Why do you think, in that example that I used a while ago, daughter comes home and says, you know, tears, no one sat with me at lunch today. They made fun of what I was wearing. So-and-so won't talk to me. They poured my books out of my locker. And the response back is, I told you, I bought you all those cute jeans. Why aren't you wearing those jeans? And pull your hair back. Is that an empathic response? No, it's a shaming response. Could a mother who absolutely adores her child respond with that shaming response? Please say yes. Don't kid yourself. I mean, come on. If you're a parent sitting in here, then you sure as hell know the answer to that is yes. But why? Why did that happen? Where was the access to vulnerability? Where was empathy? You can't access empathy if you're not willing to be vulnerable. So if my daughter comes home and tells that to me, guess what I have to do? I have to reactivate that sweaty-palmed seventh grader who lives inside me. And I have to go, oh God, that's so hard. I'm so sorry. That's happened to me. That's happened to me when I was in middle school, and it's happened to me last week. Let's talk about it. But you can't get there without vulnerability. You can't fake empathy. Innovation and creativity, born of vulnerability. This is my favorite part. I did another TED Talk this year in Long Beach, and I told the story that during 2011 and even this year, after the big TEDx Houston talk went viral, the big calls came from Fortune 500 companies. Oh my God, we loved your TED Talk. It was great. We were all in the office and crying, and please come talk to all of our senior leaders. And it's like, okay, what do you want to talk about? Like, we don't care. Just come and talk to us. Just, if you could ixnay the shame and vulnerability talk. Every single conversation, barring maybe 10%. I said, well, what do you mean? Well, you know, you're funny. You have this great research. I think there's a real fit with what we do. We don't really do, you know, that kind of stuff around here. So if you could not mention vulnerability and shame. So just for fun, for grins, I would say, okay, so what would you like me to talk about? Yeah. Fourth quarter earnings, like frickin' don't even balance my checkbook. I'm not going to talk about that. So what do you want me to talk about? Well, the big issue, creativity and innovation. And change. We're going through a lot of change. Okay, so vulnerability is the birthplace of creativity, innovation, change. And the reason that crisis is happening is because you're not talking about vulnerability. Imagine creativity and innovation without vulnerability. I'm asking you for a work product that has never been made before. It's completely innovative. I need you to be creative, and I need you to present it to a group of people who are going to, half of them are going to think it's stupid and not understand it. No vulnerability there. And so vulnerability and innovation just can't separate them. Authenticity, being real, accountability. How many of you would agree that we're in an accountability deficit in our culture? Right. Hugely, right? You want to talk about disengagement? Let's talk about political disengagement. We have the lowest voter turnout that we've ever had in the history of voting. Why? We don't give a shit anymore. Honestly. We care, but who are you? You're up there making laws that you will never have to follow, living lives that look nothing like the rest of ours, and engaging in behaviors that would get the rest of us imprisoned, divorced. I mean, let me tell you, it doesn't matter what the system is. Politics, religion, families, schools, corporations. Shame can only rise to a certain level before people disengage to self-protect. You shame and humiliate each other in debates and commercials. I have to disengage because just watching you is degrading for me. I can't watch because you are not held accountable in the same way I am. I talk to somebody like that at work, I get fired. I sleep with three aides, I get divorced. You know, and why is there no accountability? Because there is no vulnerability. Accountability is very simple. Three things. Authenticity, action, and amends. This is what I did. This is how I'll fix it, and I'm going to make amends. All three of those are vulnerable. When I go into corporations, I can tell immediately what the culture is like around what happens when people screw up. Is there finger pointing? Is there blame? Or is there accountability, which requires vulnerability? You have to say, I'm wrong. I made a mistake, or I don't know.